Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth of PaleoParents.com. You might also know me as the broth lady, or the inventor of the hashtag More Vegetables Than a Vegetarian. I'm the co-author of several paleo cookbooks, including Eat Like a Dinosaur, Beyond Bacon, Real Life Paleo. I like to talk about health at any size, and self-love, and personal acceptance. Specifically, I have a love for lifting heavy things. If you're interested in finding more out about that, you can also find me on Strong Woman Radio.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Valentine, the PaleoMom.com. I'm the New York Times best-selling author of The Paleo Approach and The Paleo Approach Cookbook. I'm passionate about nutrient density and the intersection of diet and lifestyle with health, which really means I just love talking about science.
News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up, and you get to listen to our gossip. Everyone, welcome back to the Paleo View.
Sarah, you sound so chipper. I love it when you sound chipper.
Hello. So I've added this section to the newsletter called Coffee Talk with Stacey.
I love the image that you're using for that.
I thought that you might actually get that cultural reference.
It's classic. It's classic.
So when I say that hello voice, I hope that everyone thinks of Mike Myers being verklempt as I say it. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, then you should subscribe to the newsletter, obviously.
Yeah. No, I like that section.
Thanks.
Cool. Yeah. I'm digging it.
So I read your newsletter, and I read that this week you shared with everybody what you shared on the podcast last week. So what's your new news? What's been going on with you?
Do I have new news?
I don't know.
I shared a pretty personal post today on the blog that went pretty viral, which is kind of, it was one of those posts that I actually read it. And then for like half an hour, I had decided like I wasn't going to post it. Like I wrote it and then I was like, I'm not going to post it. I was, when you write an angry email. And then you delete it and then you write a much more measured response, because that's also something that I do. That's kind of what when I first sort of finished writing the post, I sort of felt like that was sort of the genre of post it was. And then as I went back and I reread it and I thought, actually, it was something I really wanted to share. And I think, you know, people who've been following me and especially people who followed me on like multiple platforms. So they follow me on Facebook and they also listen to the podcast, maybe they read my newsletter. They've gotten all these bits and pieces before, and it wasn't any new knowledge, but it was sort of laying it all out in one place as one story of just how the stress of everything that I have been doing over the last 2 years sort of slowly started to eat away at me, and how it really impacted me. And not, you know, it was one of those things that I've always tried to like, I'll start talking about it and then I try and stop, because when you talk about how something that is an absolutely ridiculously amazing opportunity and privilege and honor that is what we do, you know, when you talk about that in a negative way, it sounds so trite and whiny and unappreciative of this like amazing, amazing opportunity and just fantastic, you know, career that we get to have, you know, through our blogging and social media and book writing. And it's amazing. But for me, it really came at the expense of my health. And it was sort of really hard to share that in a way that didn't come off sounding whiny. And I'm still not sure I 100% succeeded. I think I still sounded a little bit whiny. But what I really did is I really felt that it was necessary to, especially in the light of my recent Hashimoto's thyroiditis diagnosis, of kind of explaining, you know, how I could have a flare of something if I'm doing the autoimmune protocol and if I'm doing CrossFit and I'm doing all these other like things that are very, you know, public and out in social media, like how how then do I get a flare? How then do I get have a health crisis? And I think that, you know, people who follow me really closely know that it's been stressful and it's, I've been doing a lot and a lot of traveling and that it hasn't been easy. But people who maybe are a little bit more removed from that sort of level of reader don't really have an understanding of how physically and emotionally exhausting the last 2 years has been and just how much stress writing books are, doing that much kind of traveling is, finding that kind of balance. And I think the big teaser that I kind of shared with everyone in that post was one of the other things that I did last year, in addition to publishing two books, was film a television show pilot.
And gasp! I had no idea from your Instagram photos and hashtag.
Well, I think a lot of people.
I know I had the, I actually knew.
Have a very different impression of what it actually is, and I am not going to share what it is this week, but I probably will next week. But you know, that's I also co-produced and co-created it, which meant that I was involved in every single step of production. And it was an awesome experience and I learned a lot and it's really fun and I'm really excited about it. I think it's gonna be a wonderful thing, but that's like a lot for a person to do in a year, and a person with a history of chronic illness, that's a lot to ask. It was a lot to ask of my body, and my body basically said, no, too much.
I happen to know that you were actively working on that while traveling and doing book tours and stuff like that. It's not like these things came back to back either. Like it was like,
we have
2 hours in the hotel. We could shower, we could sleep, or we could, you know, edit this pilot video. And you didn't get to do the first two. So
no, I was actually in post-production while we were on book tour in November. And actually I've been working on the television show pilot for a year, or just over a year. So it's been, it's completely overlapped with all of the stuff that comes with launching two books, and it came with writing most of the cookbook and all of the editing of the cookbook. So it was completely overlapping with all of that. And, you know, it's one of the most fun things I've ever done. So in many ways it was actually a stress reduction, even though it was work, just because it was so much fun. But at the same time, it took so much time away from things that actually really would have been a stress reduction, like sleeping or going for a walk or playing with my kids. And so it's been, it's been an amazing couple of years just because I've done things that, I don't think I ever even could have dreamed were possible with what started off as, outlet for my enthusiasm hobby blog. And it's amazing. And I really do appreciate every single second of it. But it really took a toll on my health. So this post was really sort of sharing about those details. And what's been really neat, it's been just a tremendous response of just how much people appreciate the honesty, because from the outside, when bloggers and authors and, see these other sort of people in sort of mentorship educator type roles start talking about all of the things they do and how great their lives are, it actually can be really alienating for people because, when people are struggling with their day-to-day lives, it kind of feels like, well, why aren't I as put together as this person? Why is this person able to do all of these things? And I think that it really resonated with people because I really just admitted to, like, I did too much. Like, when people ask me, how do you do it all? The answer is like, I can't. It's destroying my health. And so I ended with, really kind of explaining that what this has been for me is a really tremendous learning experience. And I've been able to get, through the completion of two books and the completion of a television pilot. And through the other side, I'm now really super focused on how do I structure my life so that I can do these amazing career things that I want to do and still not just sort of protect my health, but still promote the sort of further improvement of my health so that I'm really, looking after myself as best I can and still getting to do these wonderful things. And that's what I'm focusing on right now, is really trying to figure out like where that balance comes from. And, you know, I'm really trying to heal. And the great thing is I feel fantastic. And I have been super active. I've been sleeping a ton. My moods have been great. My joint pain is pretty much gone. And I've started losing weight, which is like, for me, that is such a, such a weight off my shoulders, even though the weight's clearly coming off of other parts of my body as well. But it's just, it feels so good to be seeing the scale move in that direction. And as much as I don't like to put too much stock in the number on the scale, it was for me a symptom. And so to see it, you know, see that symptom resolving as well is just really, it's really encouraging. So it's been a journey and it's not over yet, but I'm kind of at this point of reflection. So I shared this pretty intense, very personal, I tried not to be whiny post. And I just want to thank, it's been read now by like 500,000 people, which is ridiculous. And I just want to thank everyone for taking the time to read that and connect with me and comment and show your support. And it's been pretty darned awesome.
I read your post today. I thought it was brave. I knew all those things. And I know the struggles that you've had, and I can hear a difference in your voice and how you're feeling just in the last couple of weeks too. So I'm happy to, from a personal perspective, happy to see you.
Thank you. Well, I knew you read it because you texted me right away. Like, oh, Stacey's reading my blog.
So I have some news to share as well, but I think before we do that, maybe we should introduce our guest for the week, who probably has some input into some of the topics that we're talking about right now, as well as having some knowledge on this topic and our podcast topic, which I'm actually looking forward to learning about because it's not something I'm educated on at all. So I would like to welcome I think I can call you my good friend, Jennifer from Predominantly Paleo.
I'm in.
You're in. Jennifer is a local. I mean, she's not like my neighbor, I wish, but we're close enough that we can like, she makes me bagels and I'm a lucky lady.
Bagels?
I do. I get yuca dough empanadas and pierogies and bagels, and her son gets along really well with my sons, which is always great. So, but that's neither here nor there. To our viewers, Jennifer is the award-winning creator of the yuca dough recipes and does a lot of AIP recipes, and also has Hashimoto's thyroiditis. So welcome, Jennifer, to the Paleo View.
Thank you, ladies. So excited to be here.
Speaking of Hashimoto's and symptoms and stuff, I have some news that I will be blogging about and talking about as more things develop. But unlike you, Sarah, I have been feeling really, really great lately. Like, I've been talking about how I've been able to reintroduce foods back that, like, for example, dairy I wasn't able to have before I went paleo. Like, I didn't even know I had a wheat intolerance, but I'm celiac, but I knew that I had a dairy intolerance. And following the Paleo Purchase autoimmune protocol and working on, you know, simplifying my life and getting play and getting exercise and that kind of stuff has been really beneficial for me over the past year. But I had one symptom that I knew was very common with people with thyroid disease, in that I have not been losing weight. And I'm totally open about the fact that that's totally fine. If this is where my body is and it's plateaued because this is the weight that I was when I hit puberty, I think that that's fine with me. And I'm legitimately okay with the idea that I could be healthy at any size. At the same time, I had, you know, a little bit of concern about the fact that I had had some not regular thyroid tests early on. And your diagnosis of Hashimoto's kind of really pushed me into finding someone who could do more evaluative, integrative research into what could be going on with me. And while I am still in the throes of figuring everything out, I did go to the doctor last week and discover that I have a thyroid nodule, which is an indication very strongly of Hashimoto's. It could also be an indication of iodine deficiency, which I actually don't believe that I have because it's one of the few things that I intentionally consume on a regular basis.
Not the way you eat.
Right. Right.
And sea vegetables.
Right. Yeah. I like put kelp on my food on purpose. So I would be really surprised if it was an iodine deficiency. And the third thing, possibility could be thyroid cancer, which, it's a very low probability. People with nodules, it's 5% that it's cancer and 95% that it's, thyroid disease, non-cancerous. So, obviously, my fingers are crossed in favor of things going well. I did have an ultrasound, and I'm working on some blood tests, and going to work on getting my health figured out. But I would like to offer the other side of the coin to people, which is that, you know, where I think your post came from, this criticism that you received on the front end from people kind of accusing the autoimmune approach to being non-therapeutic in the way that, I'm using quotations, you claim. I offer the opposite side of the coin, which is that I literally put my thyroid disease into remission insofar as I did not have symptoms. I am no longer losing my hair. I no longer have low energy. I no longer have a myriad, a debilitating depression, which I blogged about years ago, and I'm now able to point to an autoimmune flare. So, you know, I feel really good and confident in telling people that when I blogged last year about how the paleo approach saved my health, I still feel really passionately that that's the case, because when my doctor was going through the symptoms of thyroid disease, she said to me, "Stacey, I don't think that you have thyroid disease because you don't have any of the symptoms. I think that you're not eating enough for the amount that you exercise." And I was like, "No, no, you don't understand. I like to eat." I was like, it'll be really hard for me not to eat enough. Trust me. That's not my problem. And so for her to say to me, "I don't think you have a thyroid disease because you don't have any symptoms," and then she touched my neck and felt a nodule, I think kind of attests to the fact of how effectively the therapeutic approach is working to put those symptoms at bay, despite the fact that I don't have a functioning thyroid to make the hormone. And there's no amount of diet or lifestyle that can, you know, solve a problem if you're not making the hormone. Much like type 1 diabetics aren't making the insulin that they need, you know, paleo can help, but it's not like paleo is just automatically going to, you know, make their body better if their body is broken sometimes. So in that case, I am hopeful and looking forward to going on medication and getting this figured out. I also, you know, have some follow-up that I need to do to ensure that I don't have cancer. And if I do, it will be another journey that I don't really want to go down. But nevertheless, I kind of just on the tails of you being honest and open about what's going on with you and kind of getting some flack from people, I want to encourage others to say, dude, like, I've been saying for years, I think I have a thyroid problem, but I don't have the symptoms. And here I am, like, yes, I do. I just don't have the symptoms because I'm managing it with diet and lifestyle. So yeah, there's that. Welcome to the club, Stacey.
as I said a couple weeks ago, worst club initiation ever. But I
don't know.
You didn't have to drop as low as I did. Well, I think one of the things about this for me was how much it made my health history make sense. So, you know, it was for me a new diagnosis, but almost certainly I've had this disease for something like 30 years since I was a kid. And it kind of put 30 years of health battles into a very different perspective, where it made it not my fault anymore. You know, there were so many things that, and I think this is one of the struggles that people have with Hashimoto's, is the symptoms are so easily dismissed and the symptoms are so easily just brushed off. And, you know, oh, you're constipated, you know, well, eat more fiber. And you're tired, well, you should be sleeping more or exercising more. Go for a walk. That will give you energy. And you're gaining weight, well, you must be doing something wrong. You must be eating bad foods. And there's so much of this that is just so easily just shoved to the side and ignored, or, you know, thrown back in your face as you're doing something wrong. And so for me, it's been a really interesting journey emotionally, because it's really changed my perspective on, you know, how I got to be the person that I am and who I am now. And I think that in many ways, those experiences have shaped and formed my life. And as much as when I was first diagnosed, I would have gladly given up everything to have known about this 30 years earlier. But now I've come to my senses and realized that, you know, there is a pretty big silver lining in the fact that it's allowed me to do some pretty amazing things with my life, sort of despite it or because of it, or, you know, because of those battles, it's sort of forced me into this career path, which was not, you know, not what I was doing 10 years ago. So, it's definitely been a kind of an interesting experience. And I finding that it's an experience that is shared by a very, very large number of people. So, it's kind of, I mean, it's sad in a way, but it's also very reassuring in a way to sort of know that there's just so many thousands of people who've had basically the same experience, or, you know, slight variations of the same experience. So it's a club full of really nice people.
Jennifer's in the club.
Jennifer's in the club.
I am. I've been in the club. Yeah, that was one of my first official diagnoses of my long, long list.
So why don't you give people a little kind of elevator pitch short story on,
you like Empire State Building elevator.
Yeah. Like what brought you to paleo and how it's kind of affected your life? Because you have an amazing story that I never would have believed from meeting you and talking with you and seeing kind of where you are today. So I think it would be super, super helpful. And then maybe you could introduce the idea of one of the other diagnoses that you have that we're going to talk about today. And we're looking forward to having you on to offer some experience with that as well.
Yeah. So I actually was super healthy growing up. I never missed school. I had loads of energy. I went to performing arts high school and danced like many, many bazillion hours a day. And I was good until my mid late 20s. I started having some anxiety, some panic, and then that just continued to morph into more and more symptoms over time. So after I had my first two babies back to back, they're less than a year apart, that's when I was diagnosed with Hashimoto's. And I just I knew something was wrong. I didn't know what, but I was just, my fuse was short. I was exhausted. I actually didn't have some of the textbook symptoms, but my labs definitely supported my high antibodies and stuff like that. So that was my first diagnosis. And then as time went on, that's when I went gluten-free. And I do think it helped. But after the birth of my third child, I just crashed. Like I hit rock bottom, and I can't even describe how low that was. I was, we moved out to DC around that time when she was about 6 months old, and I became housebound. I couldn't really drive. I had severe neurological symptoms, migraines and vertigo and brain swelling and heart palps. I mean, the laundry list goes on and on, but basically I was diagnosed with a lot of other things at that time, including Lyme disease, with zero history of tick bite. So, you know, that whole controversy there, that you have to have the rash and whatever, but that was one of my diagnoses. So, in the end, I had about 20 different ailments, labels, whatever you want to call them, in my medical chart, and I was treated for everything. I mean, literally, I did antibiotics, I did supplements, I did detoxes, I did acupuncture, I did whatever there was that was recommended. I tried, and I just wasn't really getting anywhere. And what really turned my life around, I would just research all day, every day, literally, looking for something that could help me and something that I hadn't tried yet, because I was very open to any sort of method of healing. And finally I found paleo, and I was like, okay, I think I can do this. I can give up grains. I'm already gluten-free. You know, that shouldn't be too hard. And the last straw was the dairy for me. I think that was, the tipping point, that when I finally gave up dairy, because I had no gastrointestinal symptoms. So I always said that I did not have a problem with dairy. And I think it was just my own refusal because I was so addicted to it. But when I gave that up, that's when I finally, I mean, literally moment by moment, I started kind of creeping my way back into the living world again. Because I wasn't driving, my vertigo would get so bad. My brain inflammation would get so bad that I couldn't even take the kids to school. So, yeah, that's kind of where we went. And one of the other things on the list of diagnoses was having very poor methylation and something called MTHFR, which I think you guys want to tackle today.
We do. That was like the best segue ever.
Woo!
It's like she's been doing this.
We do want to talk about MTHFR, and I think it's one of those things that we've had this like growing group of questions in our inbox related to MTHFR gene mutations. And it's not something that Stacey or I have personal experience with. I actually had had genetic testing done for what variant of MTHFR I had, and I'm C667C, which means I'm the completely functional type. And so I can't tell you what a huge relief it was to see that. But it's something that we get a lot of questions, and it's certainly, you know, something that I know enough about to have been relieved when I saw my testing. But it's not, because we don't have personal experience with it, and it's certainly far from my, you know, strongest area of expertise, that we thought it'd be really neat to have you come on the show and lend your extensive personal experience with this beast to the conversation, and hopefully get a much more sort of well-rounded answer than Stacey and I going, oh, which was the other option.
Right. Well, you know about methylation in terms of, you know, your ability to detox and kind of push the toxins out of your body and stuff like that. And so there are different, they're called SNPs, or single nucleotide polymorphisms for the long version. And the SNPs kind of can all contribute to how well you methylate and how well you detox and how well certain functions in your body take place. So MTHFR is one of those. And I think like up to either 30 or 50% of the population can have one part of MTHFR that is a little bit off. And usually it won't affect them that much. I personally am homozygous for the 677T. That means I have two copies of it. And so that kind of like tricks up my detox pathway. So if you think of it as like a detox highway, you know, there are going to be areas where you might have more traffic jams if you have some of these SNPs that are activated and not doing their job. So in order to correct the flow of that highway, you have to keep everything moving. And that's where, you know, sometimes you hear people who have like medication sensitivities and stuff like that. Well, if you produce enough toxins in the body and they can't find their way out, yeah, I mean, that's going to create a major issue. So in addition to MTHFR, there's so many. And so one of the things that I've noticed a lot, because I started researching this more when I, around the time that I had my Lyme diagnosis, because I was like, okay, well, what's something that all these patients are having in common? And a huge thing with a lot of people with chronic illness, aside from like autoimmune disease, which is obviously really common, are these methylation issues. And I'm seeing now, even in the paleo community more, you know, people are talking about MTHFR right and left. It's like, oh, I've got this, I've got to work on that now. And it's true, you know, you do need that methylation highway to be flowing properly. But one thing that I've noticed is you really need more pieces to that puzzle too. So MTHFR is one of many, 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 many SNPs. And what it calls for in particular are like more folate. So you wouldn't want to supplement with folic acid, which, you know, a lot of women when they're pregnant, they're OBGYN say, you know, push the folic acid to prevent neural tube defects and things like this. But actually those with MTHFR can't really process folic acid properly. So it could be detrimental almost, or can be detrimental actually. So you have to supplement with something called methylfolate or another form of folate that is broken down more properly. But there's even more to that, because in order for the folate to be metabolized correctly, you with MTHFR, you also want your B vitamins. So it's kind of like, you know, this synergistic relationship where everything really has to work together. And it's not just this one piece of the puzzle where you can focus all of your energy into that one thing. You know, it's just kind of like eating paleo, right? You can focus on eating organ meats, but if you're still eating processed sugar or packaged foods, then the organ meats are great, but you still have to pay attention to the other things going into your body. And that's kind of how I think of the methylation stuff too. So, you know, MTHFR is definitely an important thing to pay attention to. It can drive up homocysteine, which can cause increased risk for a stroke or heart attack, you know, things like that. So it's definitely something that if you know you have issues with, you want to have the right supplements, like all the B vitamins and the folates and stuff like that. But there's definitely like CBS and MTR and MTRR and COM-T. And it's just like this whole chapter of this huge chapter of things that make that methylation highway go tick. So yeah, it's complicated.
And we can skip science with Sarah now, because clearly we've got it all covered.
Oops. Sorry.
No. I think why don't I do a little science? We don't have to do a lot anymore. And then let's get into some questions, because I think that's going to be something where like we really, Stacey and I both kind of want to pick your brain a bit.
Next segment is Science with Sarah, where I take a moment to explain the details and the whys.
So, as Jennifer sort of already talked about, was the methylation cycle. And what that's referring to, the process of methylation, is basically a way of turning on and off certain proteins in the human body. So it's something that happens to proteins after they're made. And some proteins are turned on when they're methylated. Some proteins are turned off when they're methylated. And what that really has to do with, it's a called a post-translational modification. So it's a little change in the chemical structure where a tiny little group of molecules called a methyl group is added to the protein somewhere. And that either turns it on or turns it off. And there's a huge variety of proteins in the human body that are controlled through methylation, and that's really important in terms of regulating their function. So, you know, really good examples would be something like neurotransmitters like epinephrine, serotonin, cortisol, and melatonin, which, you know, melatonin is a neurotransmitter and a hormone. These are actually controlled with methylation. So when you think of, for example, the roles that cortisol have in the human body or the role that serotonin has in the human body, it's like no wonder that we want methylation to be properly regulated. And so this process of methylating proteins and then demethylating them, so we're, you know, turning them off or on, turning them off, you know, on or off, it's a cycle. So the methyl group that's added onto the proteins is recycled. And so when it's added onto a protein, it does whatever it's going to, you know, either turn off or on that protein. And then when it's taken off, it goes through this really complex cycle to be reused. And MTHFR is one of many enzymes and many nutrients involved in that cycle. But what's really important about MTHFR, which actually stands for methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase, just to make myself sound cool, MTHFR is actually the rate limiting enzyme in the methyl cycle. So it means that how effective that recycling of methyl groups is 100% determined by how effectively the enzyme MTHFR is doing its job in the cycle. So there's lots of other components to the cycle, but the part that controls how fast it goes is MTHFR. And so if there's defects in MTHFR activity, such as happens with certain gene variants, so if you have the SNP C667T, that's one of the, you know, best known gene variants of MTHFR that reduces its activity, you basically get the clog in the wheel of this methyl cycle. And so you're not recycling your methyl groups effectively, so that means you can't methylate proteins effectively. And that means proteins that, you know, need to be methylated to turn on can't be turned on, and proteins that need to be methylated to turn off can't turn off. And that, of course, then affects every system in the human body. And one of the major things that happens, because homocysteine is produced as part of the methyl cycle, and then it's typically detoxified out of the body. But what happens when MTHFR is not working properly, not only do you hinder the ability of the body to control protein methylation, but you also build up homocysteine, which is toxic and can contribute to cardiovascular disease, renal disease, neurodegenerative disease, osteoporosis, and cancer. So like lots of homocysteine in the blood, not cool. And not a lot of homocysteine in the blood is seen in a ton of autoimmune diseases. And whether that's related to, for example, vitamin B deficiencies, which Jennifer alluded to, because vitamins Bs, especially B6, B9, and B12 are critical nutrients for the methylation cycle as well. So you can have a buildup of homocysteine just from being nutrient deficient in those essential nutrients. So whether or not that buildup of homocysteine is due to nutrient deficiency or if it's due to these inact or less active gene variants of MTHFR like C667T, that sort of remains unknown. But we know that this elevated homocysteine is dramatically increases risk for a variety of autoimmune diseases, including type 1 diabetes, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, our current club, Graves' disease, rheumatoid arthritis, vitiligo, Alzheimer's disease, and even schizophrenia, which is a suspected autoimmune disease. So it's a pretty big deal to be able to you know, to find out that you maybe have I don't want to use the word defect. It's a slightly less active version of MTHFR, but it does pose a lot of extra challenges for a lot of people. And there's a lot of doctors that recommend supplements for people with MTHFR gene mutations. And generally, it's sort of making sure that all of the other parts of the methylation cycle are well supported. So you'll see recommendations for vitamins B6, B9, B12, sometimes the methylated form of them, and also betaine, which is also used in the methylation cycle, is sort of like the classic recommendations. But there is some controversy around that, and I haven't had the ability or time to delve into the scientific literature in the depth that I would need to be able to weigh in on those recommendations. Jennifer, do you supplement with B vitamins to manage your defects in methylation?
I do. I take a liquid B complex that's also got methylfolate. And for a while I did methyl B12 injections daily also, or not always daily, but at its peak, I was kind of hitting it hard. But
I love the methylated B12. That's some good stuff.
It is. It is good stuff. Yeah. And it seems to really help a lot of people too, who, especially with energy and just kind of like getting out of, you know, the draggy cycle. So, I supplement with all those, and most of my variants, or most of my affected SNPs are on the cycle with MTHFR. So that includes a couple of others like MTR and MTRR, which is kind of nice because, you know, there's like four different sort of rings to the methylation cycle. So if you break them up, you can see people are affected sometimes across the board. They've got something on every single bit of the cycle, which makes it difficult because, like, if they have, you know, a variant with COMT, they might not be able to deal with methyl donors that well. So they can't necessarily take methylfolate for their MTHFR because they have trouble with the methyls. So that's when you get into, you know, more complicated cases where a practitioner can really help sort of decide, okay, you know, which form of folate do we need to give you so that you can break that down and use it properly. Otherwise, what's the point, right? I mean, you can't just supplement with something because everybody else with MTHFR is supplementing with methylfolate. If you can't do well with methyl donors, then it's not really going to help you help correct that part of the cycle. So I do definitely focus on B vitamins. All of my SNPs that are not working at their finest, they are very B vitamin dependent in addition to the folate. So that's kind of my...
How would you recommend somebody find out about what's going on with their methylation cycle? Would you recommend doing like a 23andMe type test?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That's where I started. I did just start with the MTHFR blood test. That's all I knew about at the time. And then from there, I did do the 23andMe, and you can download your raw data where you gather all your SNPs from there. And then there are different databases online that you can plug that information into, the raw data into, and then you kind of get a more, I don't know,
detailed?
and in English that most people can understand too. So I started there, and then I've worked with different practitioners, and, you know, Yasco is probably one of the more well-known ones who has really broken it down on a level that a lot of people can read and understand, just to even be able to know which ones other than MTHFR are out there. And then once you have your own information, like from a 23andMe test, which is just a saliva-based test, you do it, you drop it in the mail, you get your results, and you can then take those to a practitioner who knows what they're doing. I think that's a really kind of integral part of this, especially if it's not just one itty bitty baby snip that seems out of whack, because the other part is that sometimes even though you have that variant, it may not necessarily be turned on. Like, for instance, I know that I'm homozygous, but I've never had high homocysteine. We've run it several times, you know, throughout this course of treatment, and it's not ever really elevated. So I don't have to be totally gung-ho. And at the same time, those who do have high homocysteine or who do have major variants, you know, sometimes they have to start really, really, really slowly. So you can't just open a pill bottle of methylfolate and pop one, which I think is like usually 800 micrograms or something like that. And that could really tear somebody up, especially if they are not already working to their potential. So that's why, yeah, you kind of want to start low and go slow with that sort of thing, and work with somebody who knows what they're doing so that they can look at the other polymorphisms and iron it all out.
Yeah, definitely a find a good healthcare provider to work with situation.
Yes, for sure.
Stacey, you just enjoying letting all the new information wash over you. Do you have any questions, or should we move on to listener questions?
I'm just hoping my test results come back without all of these additional things.
Did you get tested for?
I asked to be tested for everything they could test for. They took all the blood.
when I did my testing, it was, we did a whole series of targeted genetic testing, and then like so many markers, and it was literally like going through 12 pages of reports of and this and this and this and this and this is what this means, and when you put this together with this, this is what this means. And it can be really overwhelming, but at the same time, there's so much really super valuable knowledge in getting that kind of testing done, which I did with a functional medicine / integrative medicine doctor. And so those are two key words to look for when you're looking for a healthcare professional, somebody who practices integrative medicine or functional medicine or holistic medicine. So those are types of keywords that those types of doctors will sort of self-identify themselves as that will give you a good indication that they will be savvy to this type of detailed testing and be able to actually make, you know, really good recommendations based on the results.
Questions and Answers, where we answer questions submitted by you through the contact form on our websites, paleomom.com and paleoparents.com.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
So our first question is from Betty, and Betty says, I have celiac and chronic fatigue and have had adrenal and thyroid issues. Somehow I function, though my nursing 20-month-old still wakes to nurse sometimes 4 or 5 times a night every night. During her pregnancy, my fifth, I developed a clot and learned that I have 2 copies of C667T MTHFR. I've done SCD and GAPS for 7 years and lately can't seem to feel great. I wonder if my baby's frequent night feeding and her petiteness have something to do with my diet. Also, I continue to gain weight even though I am grain-free and sugar-free. I use stevia. That was one of my celiac symptoms before my diagnosis. I could lose 15 pounds, but even with calorie restrictions, it won't budge and is still going up. I don't fully understand this diet. I'm a nurse by trade and need to understand the science, but would like to start Monday. She's referring to the autoimmune protocol. I do have some questions. I've been in denial that I need to do the AIP, but it has been recommended to me and crossed my path too many times for it to be a coincidence. GAP says that you should not do sweet potatoes, but I seem to do okay with them. Is that okay? Why do so many IP recipes out there for occasional treats favor dates over honey? I don't like dates. It's hard for me to think about not using stevia anymore, but that was mostly for coffee and my SCD yogurt. Can cashews be used to make nut milk? What if I have trouble with coconut products? I'm on the road with my family right now, so I will be able to research more this week once we're home. I'll be poring over your website a lot this week. The hardest thing for me to let go of are my SCD yogurt and stevia, my emergency food and the only soothing food that I have, and organic coffees with heavy cream and stevia. I had bad headaches without caffeine. Oh, that's a lot of little questions.
That's a lot of questions. Which ones do you want to tackle there, Jennifer?
Ooh, me? Gosh. I don't know. Let's see. I am curious about the yogurt situation. So the SCD yogurt, is she's making that with real dairy.
SCD yogurt is made with real dairy, but it's fermented for I think like 24 hours or even more. So it's fermented for a really, really long time.
Okay.
It's down all of the proteins, or at least the vast majority of the proteins. It breakdowns a lot more protein than regular yogurt does, because regular yogurt's usually incubated for like 6 to 10 hours. So it's a really, really long incubation that is supposed to break down the protein. I doubt that it breaks down all of the protein. And so if someone does have a dairy sensitivity, you know, I know some people with dairy sensitivities say they do great with SCD yogurt, and some people with dairy sensitivities say they can't do SCD yogurt. So I think that almost certainly means that if you are sensitive to dairy, you mm-hmm. the proteins in dairy, you really can't.
Right.
The sugars in dairy, I'm sure it's fine, because that's a very different way for the body to be sensitive to something.
Right. That kind of popped out at me. I don't know why, maybe just because of my own dairy journey, but you know, sometimes I wonder if just kind of omitting that is kind of a good place to start. It sounds like she's getting ready to go autoimmune, so that's a good thing. And I also wonder about like maybe her overall hormone imbalance, or not imbalance, but if she can't lose weight, but she's still nursing, you know, that's kind of a hard time to figure out who your body is when you're still nursing, because somebody else is still relying on nutrients from you. So I know I never ever came back to my kind of foundational self until I wasn't nursing altogether, because my body always wanted to hold on to weight in order to help feed a baby at that time. So I don't know. Those were just a couple of thoughts.
She mentions her baby being very petite and mm-hmm. then feeding a lot. And that was an experience I had with my first daughter. And one of the things that we have discovered over the years, and I sort of look back and I think that probably a fairly large part of that was the fact that she was probably reacting to gluten in my, or how my body was reacting to gluten in my diet. But the other huge part of that was that I had oversupply, which can happen with thyroid issues, which Betty mentions. And what that meant was that my daughter was always getting the foremilk, which was the more mm-hmm. watery milk, and never really getting to the hind milk. And it wasn't until I'd pump off 6 ounces before I would let her nurse. Like that was how much I had to dump of basically, you know, just watery milk before she could actually get like really the nutrients that she needed in my breast milk. That really changed and helped things a lot for her, because she was getting much higher fat milk that way. It meant that I was, you know, pumping all the time, but, you know, that was just, had I known about diet changes and my thyroid back then, you know, maybe things would have been different, but I didn't.
It can be the opposite with thyroid as well. Like it could be the case that she's not making enough milk. And so the baby's trying to feed all the time because she's attempting to get.
It could be more either milk. Extreme.
Yeah. It's interesting too that you brought up the thyroid thing, because given my newly vested interest, there are a lot of things about this that, you know, indicated more thyroid problems than, and I think for me also with having the celiac aspect of it, I think it would be really beneficial for Betty to look into that further, especially because it can be triggered, you know, at pregnancies and nursing start and stop. So it could be that it could get even worse or better for her when she is done nursing. But the fact is definitely that to answer some of these little questions, sweet potatoes are great for nursing moms. I mean, I guess if you're following GAPS or SCD, you're worried about some of the bad bacteria in the gut. And Sarah's debunked a lot of why it's important to eat carbohydrate to help feed the good bacteria in your gut on some of our previous podcasts. But particularly for nursing moms, it's really important to eat carbohydrate in order to make enough milk. And it also supports hormone function, which we've also talked about on the podcast before. So all in all, I think sweet potatoes in particular would be a really great idea. And maybe coming up with some sort of alternative. There are a bazillion AIP resources out there now between Sarah's book and Mickey was on last week, I think. Mickey has an AIP book. Jennifer actually has an AIP ice cream book. And there's just a ton of websites where you could, I guarantee you, I know Sarah, it's in your book, an AIP coconut milk yogurt recipe. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this idea that the SCD yogurt has to go away, it's just a matter of reframing your mind. It's harder to think, okay, now I have this different group of ingredients I'm working within, but, you're going to get new foods like sweet potatoes and other carbohydrates that you wouldn't have had on GAPS and SCD. So maybe think positively about those and enjoy those and that sort of thing. I will particularly tell you that the reason that I use dates in recipes over honey is because it's still attached in a whole food form, including fiber. And for me, I really like the taste of dates, and I find that I don't need as much dates as I would need honey to sweeten something. And it also means that you're getting minerals and fiber with the sweetener. So that's why I personally sweeten with dates. I don't know. Do you guys sweeten? I know sometimes you do, Sarah.
I do a mix. For me, it's usually a chemistry thing. So sometimes the fact that dates kind of can help hold something together, and because they have that fiber and they kind of have that texture, that makes it a better choice. And I really like honey because it's delicious. So I often end up using honey just because, you know, for the flavor. If I don't need dates for the chemistry, I just really like honey. And honey's got some other great health benefits if it's not being cooked. So, you know, it's certainly different benefits from dates. Dates have a much higher vitamin and mineral content, but honey's got some neat stuff in it, and it's antimicrobial, and it may actually help, you know, reduce allergic type reactions. And so it's got some interesting properties as well.
Cashews for nut milk. What do you guys recommend for alternatives to nut milk?
Yeah, you can use cashews. I love cashews.
I mean, if she wants to go full autoimmune protocol,
right? That might not work.
Cashews would not be okay. And she says, "What if I have trouble with coconut products?" So I was going to say, like, I would do coconut milk instead. If she has trouble with coconut products, it depends on the use, like exactly what she's trying to do. If she's trying to put something into coffee, you know, it depends on exactly what, you know, a lot of people have problems with coconut products, but they're fine with coconut oil. So blending in some coconut oil, or maybe playing with like a cultured grass-fed ghee. So the culture.
Well, she can have coffee. I think she acknowledges that.
Yeah. So, well, she talks about having headaches without caffeine. But she could be doing like an herbal coffee or an herbal tea, or, you know, the problem with headaches without caffeine, that's sort of a classic vascular health problem. And so that type of problem actually means that you would want to be working on the vascular health nutrients, like a lot of omega-3s, coenzyme Q10, which you get out of heart meat, fat-soluble vitamins, you know, a lot of seafood and organ meat type things, which would come with the autoimmune protocol. And you'd actually want to be building up your nutrient stores on those while gradually decreasing caffeine. So you wouldn't actually want to just go cold turkey with with coffee in this kind of situation, because it's just going to make her miserable. And she doesn't have to be miserable. She can actually, you know, be working on the diet stuff and then gradually working to reduce caffeine. Stevia, you know, Jennifer mentioned, and I think very astutely, that there could be some hormone issues going on. And stevia has been shown in some animal studies to bind with androgen receptors and mess up hormone signaling. And it's not really known if this happens in humans, although there's strong enough evidence in the animal studies to make me not recommend stevia to anybody. That would definitely be something to give away. And I think it's kind of stuck in that there's this a slightly different philosophy between GAPS and SED and the autoimmune protocol. So your autoimmune protocol takes out foods that have inflammatory compounds in them, and it takes out foods that are known to damage the lining of the gut or feed the wrong type of gut bacteria in the gut. But at the same time, it leaves in these foods that are full of prebiotics. So it leaves in foods that have lots of soluble and insoluble fiber. And it leaves in some natural, sugars. And so one of the things that I see when people try to, they come from one to the other and they try to kind of mesh those ideas together, is it ends up becoming a diet that's so limited that it becomes a nutrient deficient diet, because it's just impossible with such a limited diet to get the complete and balanced nutrition that we need. And it also becomes a diet that's really extremely difficult to actually stick to. So I think that, she said in her question that she's not feeling well on GAPS and SCD. One of the things that happens on those diets is people end up being so deficient in prebiotic fibers that they end up having gut undergrowth. And so it's definitely worthwhile trying the autoimmune protocol from there. But I think if she's interested in the science, like, that's what the paleo approach is it's all of the science behind the book. And I'm not going to summarize a 250,000 word book succinctly right now. But I think that, working on gradual introduction of more vegetables, more starchy vegetables, and swapping out natural sweeteners for, I know stevia is a natural sweetener. I just used air quotes again. But sugars that the body actually knows what to do with, rather than fake stuff that can mess you up. That was the technical term right there.
You also have a series on sweeteners that I think you could refer her to.
I do have.
You have a post on stevia. You have a post on xylitol and other sweeteners.
Absolutely. And I have a lot of why certain foods are not on the autoimmune protocol and why other foods are important in bits and pieces all over the blog. So that information is all readily there. But I think, I think it's just a question of, starting to reintroduce some of these, fruits and vegetables that are missing from the diet, doing it slowly. And because one of the things that happens is your bacteria in your gut actually help you digest those foods. And so when you've been GAPS or SCD for a really long time, you reduce the levels of those bacteria so much that when you eat them, you get really bad gastrointestinal distress. And that's because you're not digesting them appropriately. And so you want to kind of go slow, reintroduce those foods slowly, work on seafood and organ meat to get that nutrient density, and then work on substituting stevia for honey or maple syrup or dates. It's okay if she doesn't like dates. And working on gradually reducing the caffeine. It doesn't have to be, this is one of those situations where definitely sort of knowing what the goal is and kind of taking little steps towards it is much more appropriate than just jumping in with both feet.
Sweet. Anything else, Jennifer?
No, ma'am.
Oh gosh, I really don't like that.
All right, so let's do one more question, even though this is already a long podcast. But this is a great question. I like it. So it's from LaDonna, and she writes, 10 years ago, prior pregnancy failed at 20 weeks due to complications from MTHFR gene, which prevents the body from converting folic acid. The baby had a sacrococcygeal teratoma. That was pretty impressive pronunciation on my part, right?
I am impressed. I was curious how that was going to turn out.
Pretty big in size on her spinal cord. So I saw an endocrinologist. She did the MTHFR test and said I had it. And all she said is to take 1 gram of folic acid before trying to get pregnant. She really left a lot to be desired. I have been paleo for about a year and a half. I avoid gluten like the plague. And even when I do cheat, if I cheat, it's usually making a paleo goodie from Stacy's site or Sarah's or balancebites.com. I just love you too, and I want you to keep up the excellent work. Sarah, this question is more directed towards your scientific background. I looked around on your site and didn't see anything about MTHFR, so I'm not even sure if you're familiar with it. But my question to you is, do you think I could eat a ton of organ meats like liver, which are loaded in folate, in addition to supplementing with a methylfolate supplement? The doctor I see here actually recommended I take 1 gram of folic acid, which isn't even on par with what the research says. I'm hoping you have some guidance for me, not sure what else to do, and my hubby and I really want a baby as I'm nearing 30 in a month. That was a lot.
Jennifer, I think you already alluded to this folic acid in your earlier, but maybe some.
Yeah, I definitely take a look at the form of folate. I see she's asking, can she do just a methylfolate supplement with the organ meats? But really, I'm thinking if she doesn't have a functional medicine doctor or an orthomolecular type doctor who can kind of pick apart more than just MTHFR, because maybe, you know, the methylfolate is definitely going to play a role, but if she's continuing to try to get pregnant and it's not happening, maybe there's another bit there that can come into play. So I'd be curious to see kind of like her whole methylation lineup and not just the MTHFR, but definitely I'd be careful with the folic acid. I know that can be kind of troubling when the doctors are recommending to take it. So obviously I'm not giving medical advice.
Especially if the doctors are recommending that she take folic acid, whereas not being able to convert folic acid may have been part of the problem why she lost her first.
Right, exactly. Baby,
right, like yeah. That's intense, and that doesn't sound like a well thought through recommendation.
But I think it's a common one. Unfortunately, it's just kind of this is what I learned to do, and take your folic acid. And after a terrible loss like that, I'd want to be seeing somebody who is really well versed in how to pick MTHFR apart with the other SNPs and hopefully get her body back on track.
She is right in the sense that liver and other organ meat is really fantastic in terms of all of the nutrients for supporting the methylation cycle. And that, you know, is definitely something that should be really helpful. But, depending on exactly what the gene mutation is and what else is going on in her body, it may be enough and it may not be. And that's where a really astute medical professional should be able to help answer that question.
Is that a wrap?
Well, I was going to say to LaDonna that I'm sorry she had to go through all that.
I'm sorry too. Yes. It's terrible.
And then I think that is actually all of the insight we have for her question.
Yeah, the only other thing that I would add is that we've covered the folate versus folic acid topic before, and that really applies to more than just this particular topic. And so far as it just not being a good complete supplement, the folic acid. So applicable to everyone. Well, thank you so much for coming on and lending your insight to this topic, Jennifer, because I obviously have absolutely no clue, and I know it helps, Sarah, that you've had some experience with it personally. So thank you for coming on. Can you remind everyone where they can find you and some of the upcoming projects that you have going on?
You bet. I am at predominantlypaleo.com and, of course, on all social media. And then we've got, we just launched this week, Zenbelly and I launched our Yiddish Kitchen ebook, and with the bagel recipe that I handmade for Miss Stacy.
It's delicious.
And actually, I think one of the recipes is going to be on Paleo Mom this week. So we've got that. And then keep your peepers peeled.
I think it will actually be already on the site. It's going live Wednesday. So I think it's already going to be on the site by the time this podcast airs. So people can go look for it then.
Yes, look for that. And then this summer, my print book comes out, Down South Paleo. So it'll have all those Southern favorites made paleo.
Super excited about that.
I need to get in on some of this free food cooked by Jennifer action.
I had Thanksgiving with Russ, so you need to just appreciate what you got.
You had a pierogi, Sarah, remember?
I did, and this is why I think I need more. Oh, good. And I'm not trading Russ, but I'm just trying to figure out how to have it all. That's all. That's just that.
I'm pretty sure you wrote a post today about how you cannot
have it all.
Have it all.
Touche. Touche. Can I not have it all when other people are cooking me food, though? Wait a minute.
Let's just leave it at that awesome punchline.
Stress reducer. All right. It was a good punchline. You can have it.
It was great to talk to you, Jennifer. Have a good one, everyone, and we'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
I can hear like some desk noise.
I'm moving. Oh, okay. So you're talking, that's me.
Whomever is shuffling.
That would be
stuff.
Me. That would be me.
Make sure to mute your phone.
It's just going to be done in a second.
Okay.
I am going to start that over again because I just flubbed it so many times.
I was just feeling like, hey, you messed up for once. Because every time I read the questions, what happens.
I have had a really hard time reading out loud today. I don't know what's been going on. I was reading Rainbow Fairies book earlier, and I just started making stuff up because it was just not going well.